up on this week's show, play your GameCube online again.
Why you can't give away some old games.
And we celebrate classic Apple machines with Macintosh Librarian.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books, who actually just celebrated their 10th birthday this week. Come on, let's hear it for Sam and the team there at Bitmap Books, who've actually published over 29 books in the last decade. So celebrate their birthday and treat yourself by checking out their full range of retro gaming books, including their incredible new N64 Visual Compendium. That and the rest of their collection online right now at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, of course, you know about them. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototypes with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards. And if you're in the market for services like 3D printing and injection molding, they've got you covered as well. And they're massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 422, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Gareth Hamer.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast, of course, a show that every single Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back through those kind of bendy time things that you see in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and other things that take you back in the good old days. That's what this podcast is like. We take you back to classics like the 80s and 90s, the arcades, the 8-bit machines, Mega Drive, Super Nintendos, PlayStations, all of that and more. And of course, with it being the start of the longest weekend here in the UK, it is Good Friday. That means 4 days off work for many people, including our Joe, who's having a bit of a skive today, away with the family. So we thought we'd get someone to step in for him. And actually, I don't think you got much say in the matter, did you, Gareth, whether you came on the podcast?
No, I didn't. I was kind of told that I'm coming on to the show. Yeah.
Well, anyone that hangs out in our Discord or has joined us on our Patrons Hangouts, I'm sure will be familiar with Gareth. You're a huge part and a very valued member of our community, Gareth, and it's incredible to have you on. But for people that might not have joined us in those corners of the internet where we hang out, give us a bit of your background then. I mean, what's kind of your interests in retro? What are you into?
Everything, you know, hoarding CRTs all the way, anything from, well, actually the Dragon 32 was my first computer.
Nice.
So anything from there onwards, I'm pretty much into.
And so, also, you suggest quite a lot of news in the Discord as well. Mm. So you probably had quite a lot of input into the Retro Hour as well previously.
Well, I do have an easy job, so I do get a bit of free time that lets me do a little bit of internet surfing. And what's better to surf than retro news?
And anyone that's been on our Patrons Hangouts, I mean, are you doing the show from your retro den at the moment?
Not today, no, right. Because there's a bit nippy in there.
Because you've got, it's like a converted barn, isn't it, that you've set up as
it's
like
an outhouse, or, right. Well, I've been told the Americans don't like being called outhouses because it doesn't have a toilet, but in the UK, an outhouse is just a side-on apartment to the house, and yes, that's pretty much what my wife calls my house.
Yeah, got a massive LAN setup in there, you know, some incredible Doom matches.
Oh, yes, that's coming on slowly, but recently, as you've been seeing, I've been hoarding a lot of CRTs.
Mm. Got to keep that room nice and toasty in the
Oh, yes, months, they will once they're fully running.
Yeah. Well, Gareth, appreciate you taking the time to come on and do some news with us this week. And we have got an incredible guest on the second half of the podcast as well. This week, Ravi, we're going to be talking all things classic Apple.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, how long has it been since we've done a kind of classic Apple show? And it was Action Retro was the last classic show. That was about 2 years ago, wasn't it?
I literally thought that was about 6 months ago. But yeah, we look back, it was like January 22.
Wow. And, you know, I love exploring like the classic Mac. And this channel is really interesting. Like Macintosh Librarian, she's got such a unique kind of approach to how she presents on the channel. She's got a Mackie, which is this kind of virtual assistant, but it's basically a Mac that speaks.
Yeah, like a cartoon character, isn't it?
A cartoon character, a kind of companion, and it makes the channel really fun and accessible, but also she's got such a good knowledge about Macs. Also being a bit of an Amiga fan, we talk about that kind of connection between Mac and Amiga, of course, you know, me and Dan have to go down that road, and we talk about stuff like Haiku as well, and, you know, the different generations of Macs. So you had, you know, PowerPC, of course, and then 68K, and then there's all kinds of different versions of Mac. There's new devices that have come out for it, like Blue SCSI. And there's loads of really interesting information about stuff like some of the replacement cases as well that they have.
Yeah, and even going into Next as well, because obviously that was Steve Jobs' company when he left Apple in the 80s to the mid-90s, and kind of the influence that that had on Apple, because obviously we know that really it was that they took over Next and then Steve Jobs came back as a CEO. Everyone knows that story, I'm sure. But the fact that, you know, the Apple OS basically was, the Next OS was turned into the Mac OS. So it's a very interesting story. Like you said, we've covered this with a couple of people before, like Crazy Ken, we had him on a couple of years ago, Action Retro. But I think you're right, because Kate gives a real open approach to this. I think, you know, if you're someone who, because particularly here in the UK, a lot of us aren't all that familiar with the Macintosh machines of the 80s and 90s, because it wasn't much of a mainstream platform here, really, was it? I mean, we all had, like, you know, Atari STs or Amigas. So I think the fact that her channel is so accessible and she explains this in, you know, language anyone can understand.
Well, she's also come at it from an educational aspect. Yeah. And, you know, we didn't have Macs in school. Like, it's very late for me to actually see a Mac. I think the first one I saw was a PowerPC machine. We had the BBCs and the, you know, Archimedes. But having like a kind of educational aspect of it is really interesting, because there's a lot of crossover. Like, you know, what was the programming language as well that they had?
Logo, we talked about.
Logo, that was it. Yes. And we talk about that, and we kind of talk about some of the edutainment and that kind of road of the Mac as well.
Yeah, so if you've ever been interested, I mean, so, you know, the Macintosh is such a big platform today. If you're kind of wondering a bit about the legacy of it, Kate's channel is fantastic. It's called Macintosh Librarian. She actually had a picture. She was at VCF recently with Bill Hurd, who was one of Commodore's famous engineers back in the day, hugging a Macintosh computer. So if she can get
First
Bill to do that.
First time he's touched one.
Yeah, before he'd be like, oh, get it away. But Kate actually made him fall in love with the Mac. So you're going to really enjoy our guest this week. She's coming up, the Macintosh Librarian, on the show in around 35 minutes from now. Now, I did go and see the new Ghostbusters movie at the weekend. You guys been to see it? Yeah, you seen it, Gareth? I know we were talking about it in Discord a while ago.
No, I kind of forgot to go. I booked it, but didn't go. But I will get round to it.
I've not seen any of the new Ghostbusters. I've stuck to the originals, and I'm kind of staying with them at the moment. But I hear the new ones are quite good. So, you know, maybe I'll get involved.
Well, there's been a bit of a mixed reaction to it. I mean, I'm talking about this because obviously I'm a big Ghostbusters fan, you know, lifelong fan of the Ghostbusters.
You posted a picture of you in the cinema before anyone arrived, sitting there waiting with your Ghostbusters popcorn, you know, mega fan, yeah.
And my sippy cup with the
Ghostbusters. Do they have the main actors in it more than the last one, though?
A little. Well, Ray, without giving too many spoilers, Dan Aykroyd, he's in it a lot more.
Oh, good.
And he has a very good role in it, actually. But the rest of them, like, you know, Winston and Peter, are in it a little bit, but not all that much, really. It's really a story of kind of passing it on to the next generation a bit more. But it's, I think that, you know, the fact that it was set in New York, I'll have seen the Ghostbusters back in their native town, which was awesome. But I think a lot of people weren't that impressed with it. I enjoyed the film. But one thing that really stood out to me, and I think this was the only time I spoke to my missus during the entire film, was to lean over and go, see that behind Peter? That's a Commodore PET, you know. see what Ray's it? That's a BBC Micro. I did spot two retro computers in it, and she just like kind of shot me a look back that said, you know, you nerd. But yeah, it was cool to see some retro computers in the new Ghostbusters movie. And I was chatting to a friend of mine, Adam, you know Adam as well, Revy. He thinks he might know the museum that kind of lent the computers to the film.
Well, that's really cool. I think, you know, when they're doing these like time accurate ones, we're seeing a lot more old computers in the movies and accurately done. Like I remember the Amiga 1000 in Stranger Things, and that was really exciting to see.
Yeah, it's just really cool that retro is everywhere you look these days. So long may it continue. And lots to talk about on this week's podcast as well. It has been another busy 7 days in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology. And let's start with a story that is actually quite interesting. I think Joe would have enjoyed this one as well, because he was a massive GameCube fan back in the day. You much of a GameCube gamer, Gareth? Did you have one?
I love the GameCube. Though online is something I've never done.
Well, I must admit, I was late to the game with a GameCube. I got mine probably around 2010, 2011, when I think I picked one up for about £15, which I'm not sure how much they go for today. I've got a feeling probably more than £15. But you're right. I mean, obviously it was of that era, where, you know, obviously the Dreamcast was around at that time, which was an online capable console. We had the original Xbox where, you know, a year or two later, they really were pushing Xbox Live. But I must admit, I've never really thought of the Nintendo GameCube as being an online system. But it turned out back in the day, there were actually a few games that were playable through quite a rare broadband adapter.
Yeah, it's interesting because they were basically available on the service that was on at the time, which is now kind of been turned off. And the broadband adapter was quite an expensive thing to get. But there's a new adapter which doesn't play all the games, but it's starting to become something, you know. And you can play a few games on it, and games are getting custom built for it. But let's kind of explain how it works first. Of course, you're going to have a modified GameCube, which is using a thing called Swiss. Have you used this, Gareth? Yeah.
It's something I use. I use the Pico Pi, and I soldered it in, did all that myself. And yeah, you need to use Swiss that gives you access to the, I'm assuming, modified software to play games.
Yeah, so what it does is the online multiplayer function of it, we covered earlier, Phantasy Star had redone their kind of servers. You know, there was a fan-based server that was running on there. That's available on this. But they've started to hack games that would be, you know, played
locally. That's the most intriguing part.
Yeah, co-op. And then they're kind of doing it so, you know, Mario Kart can then connect to a private server. And it's basically hosting it, you know, a kind of local game online. People can all join. And that functionality is getting added to other titles. But it's going to be a slow process doing that. It's going to be, you know, you're probably going to have to pick a time when everyone's playing online. It's going to have to be more quite an organized thing. It's not just going to be getting online, going on a service, finding
thousands of people playing it.
And loading any game that you wanted, but it's really impressive to see.
But do those servers connect to people who play it on the PC as well? Because that would definitely up the player count.
Yeah, I don't know if it's cross-compatible with that. Yeah,
The idea of modding Zelda Twilight Princess to have multiplayer, that's definitely intriguing.
Yeah. That's bonkers.
And I think the good thing about this as well is, I mean, we mentioned that I've never seen a GameCube broadband adapter. I haven't looked at the prices, but I imagine rather expensive. I know from experience of Dreamcast, one can set you back like £300 or £400 now if you want to get one of those. And like you said, Ravi, the official online functions have, you know, long since been turned off now. But this is it's a new independent project that actually looks very, very inexpensive. These are community made, open source as well. And there's two different variants of this. It's called the ETH2GC. And they do these in two variations, a sidecar and a light version. So you can buy these either as do-it-yourself kits for $35 or fully assembled for $45. That's a sidecar version. Or there is the light one, which can be $15 for DIY or $25 for the assembled version as well. It does mean that apparently the sidecar one is a bit more fully featured. It's a bit more plug and play. But I think for that price, though, I mean, that seems like a bit of a no-brainer if you still play your GameCube regularly.
Yeah, that's really cool. And like, I think also, you know, sometimes these devices, they're too expensive and that kind of pushes people out. But, you know, if you want to get more people online, you want to get more people onto these servers, do something this cheap, chuck it out there and, you know, people are going to buy it without a second thought and it will just straight away become something. And I think the difference with the sidecar and the light version is the light version seems to be the open source one, where the sidecar seems to be the commercial kind of product. So it's a little bit slicker looking and it fits kind of, you know, it mounts the Ethernet from the front.
Yeah.
And the other one's kind of like into the side, but open source as well. So maybe we'll see more developments, more add-ons to that. You might see a wireless one. Who knows?
Well, could we see multiplayer for Game Boy games in the future with the Game Boy player?
Yes. I think that's
using some sort of connection. Like, I know we're dreaming, but it's still nice to think that it could happen.
You're gonna have a dream, Gareth.
I think we covered it with the sync cables that people were doing, like online functionality hacking.
I do remember
sync cables.
I do remember the broadband adapters being used in the early days to actually back up games.
Yeah.
It was one of the few ways to actually back up the games. Now, I'm pretty sure every game's backed up now. But why keep people are still hoarding the adapters, I'll never know.
Well, it does say, yeah, one of the functionalities of this is that you can rip GameCube games to your PC. So if you have got a collection of them, you want to play them, you know, legally in emulation, I think, you know, that's a nice little feature to have. But yeah, very cool. I think, you know, for the price, I mean, yeah, like I said, that kind of feels like if you play a GameCube, it's, you know, worth a couple of dollars just to get one or build it yourself. And you're right, Ravi, the way these work generally, because I did connect to a service, God, I'm probably going back a decade or so ago, where I played my original Xbox Online, had to run like a server on my PC, and then I connected an Ethernet cable from my PC into my Xbox, and then there's a third-party service you could connect to, but you basically had to look at their forums, and it'd be like, you know, Saturday night, 6 p.m. GMT, we're all jumping on to play Halo 2. So that is how you'd organize a game. You know, generally you get a bit of pre-warning and you plan it a week or two in advance. So
yeah, and I think the fact that you've kind of got a group that are doing this, WebHDX, you know, they're hosting some of the private servers, so it's in their interest to kind of keep them going as the product's going. So I think that's quite good. It's not just like a random server that some bloke set up on his PC that's going to turn off. No.
Yeah, well, these are available now, so if you want to check that out, I will link that up in this week's show notes as well. Now, you know, I regularly do this, Ravi. We often have a little walk around charity shops, as they're called here in the UK. And our friends over the pond call them thrift stores. Our friends down under, op shops, I think they're called in Australia. These are basically charity shops. What are they like near you, Gareth? Are you doing much looking around the charity shops in your
area? Oh, I'm always in CEX. But there's a few charity shops. Mm. And yeah, you'll always see a very specific game here in the UK in some of those shops.
Yeah, normally a few of them. Normally FIFA. I see around here.
FIFA, Madden,
the sports games.
Yeah,
all the sports, all the fitness games that people have bought trying to get healthy and kind of given up on. Give it
you
to
know
a charity
what, though?
Shop.
They had a big comeback during COVID. I remember, you know, the Wii boards. They suddenly like tripled or quadrupled in value. Everyone's trying to get hold of them, and like Wii Sports and stuff. Suddenly, it was like
Just Dance and stuff.
Insane prices. Yeah, obviously, people trying to exercise at home. But you're right. Generally, if I go around any charity shop near here, the only thing I ever see, and I always send pictures normally to you, Dana, Ravi, and Joe in our little Facebook group, like, oh, another copy of FIFA 09, and there's FIFA 10, FIFA 11, FIFA 12. But it turns out that you can't even give away these games. So you wonder how long these stay in charity shops, because this story made me chuckle a little bit. I spotted this on Reddit, and this was a user called Steve Lin, who is on Blue Sky, and he's a member of the Video Game History Foundation. And he was recently at the Electronics Flea Market, which is apparently a really long-running, basically a swap meet in Northern California. And obviously you see all the usual stuff there, the old consoles, a lot of people selling games as well. But he said there was one guy who basically had a big box of NBA 2K19 for the Xbox One. And there is a picture of this in here as well, so this is legit, with a little handwritten sign on it that says, "Free, take them all." And these are sealed copies of NBA that literally nobody wanted for free. Does it shock you that he couldn't even give these games away?
No, not at all.
I was just thinking, did he have a CEX?
I think the most shocking part of the article was is that you could take the games, but you weren't allowed to take the box that the games were in.
Because, I mean, I'm looking at this, and the way I interpreted that was basically take one. But yeah, basically saying you can take them all if you want, but you're right, they're in like a big plastic carry-all box. Yeah,
you know, I love the NBA 2K series, but it was like in the Dreamcast days. So NBA 2K2 was like really, really good fun. And I quite enjoyed that. And, you know, basketball is not a sport that's kind of native to me or something that I understood that well. Like, I was like, oh, what's a backcourt violation and all of this kind of stuff.
I'm but, too short to play basketball.
Yeah, that series really got me into it, you know.
Yeah, well, to me, though, because I'm looking at this, and if I was at a retro event, like say I was at Play Expo or something, I'd always take one if it was offered for free. So I'm kind of staggered that people didn't even take one or two of them. It just seems a bit bizarre to me. Because even if it wasn't a game that I was going to play, it's still a free video game. And there are people, you know, on this Reddit thread as well, people saying, does it kind of seem like, you know, people are valuing like modern games less now? That, you know, after a couple of years, they're basically so disposable, you can't even give them away?
Well, I think it's those that mad job lot thing. So, like, yeah. There was this thing, I was on eBay for a while, and they had a, you know, the Wicker Man 2006 one with Nick Cage. And, like, it's meant to be really awful film. I've not seen it myself, but I've heard about it, and there's like a job lot of, like, you know, 2,000 copies of it, and on eBay everyone's like, oh, you can't give this away. But then because it's Nick Cage, everyone like went mad and kind of turned it into a bidding war. I was thinking, like, what would you do with that? Build like a house out of copies of the Wicker Man, or tile your floor or something.
I personally think it's going to happen more often down the line. Yeah. You're going to start seeing more, like, and over here you're going to see more FIFA, you know, in boxes. Until
like
things
huge
actually go
job
fully,
lots of,
yeah, exactly.
Of FIFA,
until everything goes fully digital, it's going to happen.
I was in a charity shop that I haven't been in for a while, actually, a couple of weeks ago, and they had some copies. I think it was one of the, it was a racing game. Might have been like an old Gran Turismo. I think it might have been actually, and a couple of copies of FIFA for the PlayStation 2 in this charity shop, and they had them nicely displayed on a stand on the top of a cabinet. You know, kind of made a feature out of them. And I looked at that and I thought, that's quite interesting that they've made a feature out of PlayStation 2 games. Now reading this, I'm wondering whether they've been on top of that stand for like 20 years and they're just going to give them away.
Maybe.
quite shocking to see that. I think I always take a free video game, you know, if I was offered one, but apparently not a copy of NBA 2K19 for the Xbox. So if you want to check out that article, I'll link that in our show notes as well. Now we're getting ready for Ravi's big event that is coming up in Nottingham this summer, Kickstart 02. I'm sure you're going to be talking more about that on the podcast over the next few weeks, Ravi. Of course, it is your big Amiga show, the second one that you're doing in the UK.
Pete Cannon there as well, who's pretty relevant to this story, I think.
Yeah, we had Pete Cannon on the podcast a couple of years ago. He's actually someone who makes music that actually is very mainstream successful, isn't it? You know, chart music and stuff on the Amiga. And we had that video recently of Calvin Harris backstage at the Brit Awards playing around with his Amiga 1200 that I think he actually used in his onstage performance, looking back at that. But it turns out the sound of the Amiga is becoming quite popular at the moment, and there is a brand new plugin that basically means people can make pretty authentic sounding Amiga music for £10 using a modern digital audio workstation.
I think this is really, really cool because it's Amiga emulation, but it's cheap. So when people would originally do the samples, they would do it either using a little pack, which is you know, something that you'd have on the back of your machine that would probably be in the serial or the parallel port, and it would be a like little sampler, one of the Technosound Turbo ones. I remember
a friend of mine had that, and he had his Walkman with like a basically a cable between his Walkman and the sampler, and he pressed play at like the moment he wanted a drum.
Yeah, and sometimes there'd be a mono as well, so you'd have to take like the left channel and then replicate it on the right, you know, and like, the sampling wasn't amazing. It was kind of limited as well, but also it had a certain quality that I'm not sure this has, which is the buzz, which, you know, I DJ a lot of mods, and I love when someone's really badly sampled something and you've got like really
the ground loop in the background.
Ground loop in there. Or they've got, you know, some interference from electricity. I love that kind of sound.
Well, Gareth, before we get into this, did you ever try and make music on your computers back in the day? I'm quite curious.
I probably tried, but I probably got stopped very quickly. I am tone deaf.
Yeah, by a good friend.
Oh, yeah.
I was the same. I tried to make stuff in like Pro Tracker and stuff like that. And I remember my brother and I messing around with them. And I think I might still have some on disc somewhere that kind of made my ears bleed when I listened.
Best I would have tried to have probably remixed Lemon Tunes.
Yeah.
At best.
Well, this makes it really easy then, Ravi. And I actually saw that Pete Cannon has approved. He's given his like positive review to this plugin. So does this offer?
So what this does is it does it in the Akai style. So the Amiga, obviously you'd have your home sampling and you'd do it like that, and you'd have the sampler that would look a lot like the GUI interface on this. But the real kind of producers that use the Amiga, they used a separate Akai sampler. So, you know, we had Alistair Brimble, who talked on the podcast, and he talked about how they would get 16-bit samples. They would reduce them down to 8-bit. So if you want a really clear drums, you would use one of these Akai samplers, you know, sample it in 16-bit, then reduce it down, then put it onto the Amiga and do it through, you know, one of the trackers. They'd also do the time stretching for like all those jungle tunes, you know, on the Akai samplers.
And I thought you're going to try and copy these time stretching effect with your mouth then, Ravi.
Why? And that's kind of put me off. But yeah, they'd kind of use the Akai functions. They were certain sounds that, you know, really represented that time, that kind of jungle production, but they're very expensive to buy. Now, if you're using the actual hardware, it's going to cost you loads. Then you're going to have to put it into the Amiga. It's a long, laborious process where this is £10. Run it on your Mac, run it on your PC. You can straight away convert it to that 8-bit format. Really clear. You can downsample it. Yeah, this is just a really useful kind of piece of software and emulation.
What it offers as well, you can actually load, because the Amiga had a format called IFF, didn't it?
Yeah.
Which was what you'd load the sound samples in. This supports that as well. So if you've got some of those vintage libraries, you know, like your old soundtracker discs from back in the day, they will work on this too.
Yeah, you're not sitting there converting or doing any of that. It does it all, and then you fire it out, and you could probably even build it in an emulator using ProTracker or something, or OpenMPT, which is a tracker program that's based on the PC.
And even the look of it as well. It looks like ProTracker.
Well, it looks like ProTracker, but also I used to use one called Audio Imager.
Right.
It looks pretty much exactly like this. All Amiga samplers had this, and, you know, the little modes that you have and the reversers and stuff.
Yeah, and it's got some great reviews. Yeah, Pete Cannon said, hands down the best Amiga emulation I've ever used. He loves the time stretch and the chord options in there as well. Cheetah, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Ravi. He said it's banging for old school. And I have a little sample here as well. There's a bit of time stretching for you.
Yeah, better time stretch than me. But also those bass tones as well, like getting that really low Amiga bass was really important, and this does that.
Yeah, so for all the jungle is massive. £10 if you want to get that on your Amiga. I'll link that in the show notes as well. Now, this next story I thought was quite interesting. I mean, how many Tetris clones have there been over the years? Probably more than we care to remember. Although I did quite get into Tetris 99 on the Switch a couple of years ago. That's probably the last big Tetris game that I got into. And also, do you remember Tetracopy on the Amiga? Did you ever use that back in the day?
No, not something I used.
Well, this was a disc copy program, a bit like Xcopy, but you'd actually play Tetris while it copied your discs. So that was very cool.
Okay, that's definitely different.
Yeah. So the Saturday afternoons used to fly by as a kid with that. But now, this is quite interesting because this is basically, it was meant to be a modern Tetris sequel that kind of stalled. But the headline here is, you know, never mind all the millions of clones and everything. This was by the original Tetris creator. He was co-working on this, Alexey Pajitnov. So what is this, Gareth? Explain how Tetris Reversed works and what it is.
It looks like you get your shapes and they move down, but you kind of have to delete the shapes, not the lines. So right. I don't know if it's kind of a fill the gap, but you have to get through the other gap or the other shapes. So it's very confusing.
I think part of it is that we've only got screenshots of it, not video. Yes, I guess if we saw it playing, we might kind of be able to work it out a bit more.
Which is weird because apparently they were showing a demo of it on stage for 10 minutes at GDC recently, and there's an article about it on IGN where it says it doesn't look like anyone actually filmed it, which is quite bizarre in this day and age.
It looks a bit like Minesweeper to me, to be honest.
The game was so good it just shocked people they couldn't even record it.
Yeah, couldn't take their eyes off the screen to get the phone out. Well, the headline on Time Extension in their article is, it is Tetris for 300 IQ people, which might explain why it took me a bit to get my head around this. But I love the story of this because obviously we had, we talked about the Netflix docudrama about Tetris on the podcast a couple of years ago when that came out. Obviously become a very famous story of Alexey Pajitnov creating it behind the Iron Curtain back in the day. Obviously became a massive smash on the Game Boy when it was a pack-in on that. I mean, did you guys have any favourite versions of Tetris that you played back in the day?
For me, it was Wear Tricks.
What was that then?
That was a game where you captured water, but you had to use the shapes that dropped down to build the land up. So you kind of made ponds, but you had certain obstacles like bombs dropping that would put holes in, or asteroids that would actually make the water evaporate, and even ice cubes that would freeze the water. So that was my favorite.
There's so many of that. Wordtris. I remember that one being around. Welltris. Hatris, there's all sorts of different variants and spins on the game.
Well, I know one that you liked, you know, it influenced a lot of games. Minsky's Furballs as well.
One that you
enjoyed.
That was a bit like a Dr. Mario kind of clone, that one. I mean, yeah, they're all kind of, you know, columns as well. They're all kind of spin-offs of Tetris, really, weren't they? Or influenced by it. But this story is quite interesting. Now, this started back in 2011 when a Croatian developer called Vedran Klanek, he went to the NLGD Festival of Games in the Netherlands, and he basically had this idea of doing this sequel to Tetris, and he had a chat with Alexey Pajitnov there about making this Tetris sequel, and obviously having Pajitnov behind it really give it some credibility. And apparently they were working on this for a couple of years, including getting a prototype version of it off the ground, but for some reason, he said most of the work happened in the summer of 2012, but then it kind of ran out of steam and nothing really happened on it after that. But it turns out that the pair actually hooked up again at GDC 2024 in recent months, and he still had the prototype of the game, and they did this little presentation on stage. Now it looks like it might be back on again, which sounds quite interesting. I mean, would this be something you guys would be interested in playing?
Oh, anything to do with Tetris, we'll definitely get a shot. Mm. But you just said you need an IQ of 300, so
yes.
This is going to hurt.
I wonder if I could get like some AI to play it for me or help me out. You know, that seems to be the end thing there.
We'll end up creating Skynet.
Yes, yeah, inadvertently. but yeah, I think it just the fact that, you know, there are so many different versions of it, but having Pajitnov involved in this, and if he kind of sees this as a worthy successor to his original Tetris concept, I think that in itself lends a lot of credibility to this, and I think a lot of people would like to play it. So fingers crossed there is a bit of a resurrection, and it, like you said, Ravi, it'd just be nice to see a video of it. That's like a starting point. So hopefully someone will get one uploaded at some point. If you want to read about that and see those few screenshots that are out there, I'll link those in this week's show notes as well. Now, this story is quite interesting and quite bizarre as well, because I'm looking at this. My first initial reaction was like a bit jaw-dropping, really. And then I start to do a bit of digging, and I must admit I am slightly sceptical about this story, but I'll see what you guys think as well. Now, this is apparently a 20-year-old patent from Nintendo, or a patent, however you like to say it, that appears to show a Nintendo 64-like console that appears to sport a DVD drive. Any takers on this one?
Oh, no, I love this idea. This makes me think of some sort of prototype that they were working on. Because by the looks of it, it's a standalone system. It's not. Yeah. It's like they probably used the Nintendo 64 motherboard and just kind of connected the DVD drive to it. But I think this is probably the GameCube in some form.
Yes.
But because that used DVDs, but mini discs, held 1.8 gigabytes, I believe.
Yeah, still not enough for a lot of games.
No. But again, most Nintendo games, if not all of them, all came on one disc. Mm. So I think for them, they were happy with that.
Well, they had some piracy devices. There was the CD64 as well, which would do backups off a huge CD-ROM. Kind of attached to the bottom, and you know, you'd have your cart in there, and you'd be able to put the images onto CD. I don't know if was DVD too early then. I don't know if I've got my timelines messed up, and also
DVD was created what, 96, 97, I believe, and that was made by Philips and Sony. I think there it's just an advanced CD, of course, just different laser or. I'm assuming some sort of nano range. I'm now confusing myself now.
Do you think that would have been a more of a deal with Philips than Sony? Because
Nintendo have a habit of using their previous systems to prototype their next one. Because Mario 3 was the prototype to Mario World, and then we end up getting Mario All-Stars. The FX chip was the prototype to Mario 64. And you got to remember the GameCube was the controller, the Wii controller was prototyped for I can't even talk now. The
game,
Wii.
Yeah. Well, the GameCube and the Wii were basically the same system under the hood.
Exactly. Nintendo have a habit of just using their own systems to test their new system. So I think this is exactly what that was.
Well, I'm looking at this, and apparently, because this is where the story to me kind of gets a little bit confusing, because there's only two sources on this story, although they're both credible sources. One of them is Game Rant, which is obviously a very well-known website, which is the one we're looking at right now. And I'm looking through the article here, and basically the story is that a Nintendo patent from 20 years ago has just surfaced. Now, the thing is, neither of the articles I've seen actually say where this has surfaced or kind of what the source is on this story.
It wasn't the Giga Leak, was it?
Well, that's what I was looking at, because I was like, has this come from like a new leak from Nintendo? And obviously you think that we probably hear about that. But also the other source is MSN. So you think that is, you know, it's a pretty credible news site, MSN.com. And they've picked up on this as well. But it just kind of struck me that there's an image here of what appears to be a kind of a square-looking system, maybe something that looks a bit like maybe an Apple Pippin or a Sega Saturn in terms of form factor.
That's a Dreamcast.
Yeah, it could be a slightly chunkier Dreamcast. It's got four ports on the front.
Has it got like some German in there as well?
Yes, which, because I'm looking at, the thing that stands out to me is it's a boxy system and it's got a Nintendo 64 controller plugged into it. There appears to be a slot on the front for what looks like a memory card. They call that a cassette port.
A time-accurate CRT as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, cassette in a lot of languages is interchangeable for cartridge. So it looks like it's some kind of very thin kind of cartridge format there. But yeah, it looks like the main storage method is on this figure here. It says DVD Laufwerk. And I did the translation what Laufwerk means, and that means storage disk.
The Nintendo PlayStation, you know.
do you think Philips might have actually kind of said to Nintendo, look, we're working on this, you know. You didn't want to do the CD, but let's have a look at the DVD.
Wasn't it Sony who did the DVD, wasn't it? It was a Sony format, I believe. They were mainly... that's the reason it was in the PlayStation 2.
Yeah.
So whether... Because it's interesting, the timing of this, they reckon this patent's from 2001. So that would have put this, you know, a good few years after the N64, but just before the GameCube came onto the market, which I think was around like November 2001 from memory. So yeah, like you said, Gareth, it looks like it could be more in line as a prototype GameCube, really. But interesting to see that N64 controller and full-size DVDs in this pattern that's apparently come from somewhere we don't know where. It's just come onto the internet this week. So it's interesting.
Oh, we love leaks.
Yeah, we do. That's the thing. So, that's the big thing for me is, because you mentioned there, Ravi, how would that change things? Because, the PlayStation 2 was on the market already for a year. At this stage, admittedly, still in 2001, it's quite hard to get hold of. But if the GameCube or the if there was a weird in-between system, I'm thinking something like, the Sega Neptune or the Atari Jaguar 2.
It was weird when they released the N64. I do remember a lot of, they're still using carts, that kind of, obviously that was disproved later on with some of the absolutely amazing titles on there and what they could fit on it.
A lot of developers left, Final Fantasy.
Yeah, when that first came out, it's like, what, they're using carts? But also, piracy as well. Maybe that could have been more rampant on there.
Yeah. So, DVDs are still quite hard to pirate at that stage. But obviously, we kind of, CDs were easily crackable. So I guess they knew that DVDs wouldn't be long until people were copying them everywhere. But it would be interesting if they released that. Whether it was just a proof of concept or something, but how weird would that have been if they released basically an N64 with a DVD drive in 2001?
Joe would have just gone mad.
Conker's Fur Day with full FMVs and all that air. Yeah. Can you imagine that? That would definitely be an 18 movie.
Yeah, even more swearing in it. Yeah, I didn't have to cut anything out of it. So,
they wouldn't have the Banjo-Kazooie language, would they?
I was one of the few people that actually waited for the N64, and I got it just as it dropped to £150. And I'm glad I did, but so many people didn't wait. And this is what I think gave the PlayStation such an advantage because of especially here in Europe, the N64 came so far behind the PlayStation.
Well, they ran those adverts, didn't they? Like, oh, you know, wait for it. Nintendo were running them for about 2 years, I think, in games magazines.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the VHS tape that you got with the first N64 magazine, and that definitely enticed me, you know, seeing GoldenEye. And my mother's not a gamer, but when she first saw GoldenEye, she was blown away.
Yeah, incredible system. And I think, you know, if it had come with some kind of optical media, you know, it would have obviously changed.
Well, we had the 64DD, or Japan had the 64DD.
Which even that, they didn't think it was going to be enough of a success to release it worldwide. So maybe it wouldn't have changed its fortunes much. And we probably wouldn't have got the GameCube if this had come along. So it would have held us back a generation anyway. So probably a good thing that it didn't. But very interesting to see that. And like I said, I'm not really sure where it's come from. I'm slightly skeptical so far. But obviously, it's only a new story. So hopefully more details will emerge in the coming weeks. So we'll keep you posted on that story. So if you want to check it out and check out those figures that have been released, that little patent that's on there, just a one pager at the moment. But we'll put that, and of course everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job. I put them in the podcast show notes, or head to our website at theretrohour.com. Now, patrons, keep it here. A couple of big news stories to talk about just for you. A new creepy platformer for the ZX Spectrum and an incredible new shoot 'em up that has got one of the best soundtracks I've ever heard for the Sega Mega Drive. We'll talk about that in just a minute. Before we do, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to a regular supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our wonderful mates at Shopify. Now, Ravi, you should know what this sound means by now.
Yes, it means a sale on Shopify.
That means you've made some money on Shopify. Now, if you're not familiar with Shopify, you need to get involved in this. If you sell anything online or in person, Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform to run, start, and grow your business. And it feels like right now, everyone's got some, you know, kind of side hustle going on, or maybe even thinking of becoming your own boss. I met a friend of mine recently, who's, you know, company he works for, has gone through a few changes. He's on about starting his own company. A lot of people are doing that right now. And Shopify is the commerce platform that is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whatever you're selling as well, I mean, we see these in person. We talked about it last week with Joe. You know, he goes to retro gaming markets where people are using Shopify card readers there as well to take the hassle out of having to deal with cash. I've seen people using these at, you know, craft stores that my missus goes to, for example, and even doing it online as well. Ravi used to be a web dev, you know, trying to set up your own commerce platform. How much of a nightmare is that?
Updating, and, you know, I can't offer 24-hour support, but Shopify can. And, you know, we've also got a big kind of cupboard full of books, and we've had quite a few people asking about the books, and I think we're going to set up our site with Shopify.
Oh, it would be stupid not to, wouldn't it? Because Shopify cover all of your sales channels. Now, that means your Shopfront point of sale systems, it can be your all-in-one e-commerce platform, even across your social media marketplaces. Take care of Facebook, Instagram, TikTok for you as well. They've got industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth, giving you complete control over your business. And the good thing is, you don't have to learn new skills. No design, no coding, nothing like that. They'll take care of it all for you, and they've got award-winning help and a massive course library as well. So ready to support your success every step of the way. So if you want to get serious about selling, get Shopify today. And of course, we've got you an incredible offer, like we always do with our sponsors. So please show them a bit of love. You can sign up for a £1 per month trial period right now, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. That is all lowercase. Try out Shopify for just £1 a month, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right then, well, thank you so much for checking out the news this week. Thank you, Gareth, for stepping in as well for Joe. Really
appreciate it. Any time now? Can I go now? Am I free to leave?
Yeah, I think go back to what you're doing now, Gareth. You're off the hook.
Yeah, thanks very much. You've been amazing.
Anytime, guys, anytime.
And stay tuned, because we have got an incredible guest on the podcast next, celebrating classic Apple Macs, Apple leases, going way back in the day, Apple IIs as well, with our special guest, the Macintosh librarian. She's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with a Macintosh librarian, Kate Fox, and she runs an absolutely awesome channel. It's all about the Mac, and you know, me and Dan love a bit of Mac chat, and it's got a focus on some of the educational aspects of Mac, but also some of the more unusual side of the Apple operating system and also the Apple machines. So how are you doing, Kate?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you on. And you've probably heard on the Retro Hour before, we always ask, what's your first computer experience?
My first computer experience was probably using the Apple IIe over at my elementary school in kindergarten. And in first grade, we had a 2E computers that were the green and the monochrome green black monitors, and playing Oregon Trail and Number Munchers and Heretica. I probably mispronounced that, but that's Apple IIe's were my first love.
It's like a total alien experience to us because we didn't have any Macs in our schools in the UK, you know, sort of BBC Micros and stuff like
yeah.
that.
So essentially what we had is in each of the classrooms, we would have two Apple IIe's. Sometimes the nicer classrooms had a 2GS in them. So there would usually be, it must have been some school funding. I do have a video about how Apple's got into schools, but it was essentially just two computers. They were networked together through Apple Talk, and it would pull software from the local network, and there would be a selection of games. And so it would be like during recess or something. We could play outside, but I think on Fridays they would give us the opportunity to jump onto Oregon Trail and have fun. And since it was networked, everyone was sharing the same image, so you could see when people died, you could see people's gravestones from other people. So you could see, like, here lies Fathead or something, and we would just all start cracking up.
It's interesting about how the Apple machines got into the classrooms in America, because like Ravi said, over here we had the BBC literacy project, where it was Acorn BBC Micros and Acorn Archimedes. I know that Steve Jobs was a big supporter of having his machines in education. There was a program called Kids Can't Wait. I believe that's how a lot of them got into American classrooms, right?
Yes, that's correct. That was something that, you know, when I started my channel, and you know, the reason why I got into making videos was the Apple computers in schools. My parents were teachers, and I grew up with Apple computers, and I was always wondering why are there so many Apple computers in schools, especially in the 90s in America. And it turns out there was a program that Apple pushed forward, and it was part a lobbying program, lobbying senators in California, lobbying other legislators to push for essentially a tax incentive to where Apple would essentially get back in taxes the amount of money that cost for an Apple IIe. So essentially the government was paying Apple to give computers to the schools.
Right.
That's how the law worked. And they made it to where what they tried to do is, if a school participated, each classroom got an Apple IIe. So it was just one per classroom, but you know, that was enough to where it sparked other teachers getting it. You know, now we have a computer. Sometimes it was that school's first computer, so that was their entry point. And you know, that program kind of spearheaded into, or created, a bunch of Apple heads here in the United States, and kind of made us all used to the concept of Apple computers.
I mean, there were some things in common. Like, for example, I remember using the Logo programming language on the BBC Micro at school, and also having a little robotic turtle that were kind of, you plot coordinates and it would move around the floor. Did you use Logo as well? Because I know that was on the Apple IIs, wasn't it, in the early Macs?
Yeah. So I'm jealous that you guys got the robots.
Oh, yeah. It's very cool.
That is really cool. I actually saw them at VCF West. But yes, Logo was another way that we used computer. We had computer lab. I think we got to like second and third grade at my school. And in that room, they would have, you know, it was kitted out with like 25, 30 Apple IIgs's, and 25 or 30 Apple IIgs's. And there, you know, they would teach us Logo. And what Logo was is essentially a very simple scripting program that allowed you to draw shapes on a screen, to draw lines. It was a great way for teaching kids how to program and think programmatically. And I do have a video on my YouTube channel, Macintosh Librarian, throwing a plug right there, but all about the logo and how Seymour Papert, who was a researcher in education and computers, and how he thought of this logo concept so that he could help kids think about how to think mathematically, to think, to not be afraid of math was really what it was all about. Not be afraid of programming. And he saw that computers were a great way to get kids excited about, you know, we're not just, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. It's not just arithmetic. Now it's, oh, cool. You actually can draw awesome shapes on a screen. You can make cool rainbow art and make it look nice. And it was actually one of the first times where I personally got to feel like I could make something happen on a TV screen, right? That's something that we take for granted now. You know, we all have monitors and screens and whatnot, but, you know, back in the 90s and late 80s, you know, that unless you were in a TV production house or you were into computers, especially as a kid, you know, seeing something that you can create on a screen that's unique and kind of expressing your own creativity through logo is something very powerful.
I think one of the first times that I used a Mac was at college, actually. And it was, you know, those G3 towers. And they just had Logic Audio on there. Do you think, like, software has kind of driven the use of creativity for the Macs in, like, educational settings?
I think so. I think that because Macintosh hardware is Apple computers, you know, your Macintosh software is only historically for Apple software. And that kind of helped software developers hone their software for that specific hardware. So like your G3 Mac with that sound software, you know, you're getting folks that are a little bit creative. They don't really want some folks, they may be intimidated by Windows and the command line. They see an Apple computer and they see something easy. They see something friendly. And at least from what I've seen, a lot of people feel that a Macintosh is something that works with you and works to meet your needs rather than you are trying to force it to do something. Mm. And I think that's why a lot of creatives kind of leaned more towards Apple computers.
And it feels a bit more professional as well in the creative world with stuff like desktop publishing and, you know,
yes,
looking at an office, you'd often see an Apple, like in a 90s office in the corner, that would be used as the kind of creative machine.
Yeah, especially in the 90s, Apple under CEO John Sculley and Jean-Louis Gasset, you know, the CEO, after Jobs was ousted, they really pushed desktop publishing, Apple's focus in the 90s, which is kind of my, you know, that's when I grew up with Macs. So I grew up with this kind of non-Steve Jobsian Macs, so to speak. But they really pushed on the desktop publishing because that's where the profit margins were. Hmm. But also, you know, you're making money with your computer. You want to invest in something that, again, just like I said, you don't want something that you're going to have to fight against. You want something that works. You want the software to be compatible. You don't want to worry if your motherboard or if you have enough memory for such and such software. If you have the latest Mac, it's going to be compatible with, you know, Illustrator or with CorelDRAW or whatever the publishing software they used at the time. But yeah, Apple had some really innovative displays also in the 90s. I know we're not on camera, but actually in my room right now, I have a really massive 20-inch monochrome display from 1989. It's an Apple 2-page display.
And wow, but that takes about three people to lift that, does it?
Yeah, no, it's really heavy. Yeah. It's easily 100 pounds, I think. Yeah. I haven't lifted it. I definitely got help when I picked it up at VCF Southwest. But it's meant to show two, you know, 8.5 by 11 pages side by side, you know, as kind of a WYSIWYG, you know, what you see is what you get situation, to where that was made for magazine editing, desktop publishing, writing newsletters and other types of advertisements, because you know, it was special to be able to actually move, you know, typeface, change fonts, move stuff around, and actually see what the final product's going to be without having to do a lot of zooming.
Yeah, I mean, we take that for granted today, but it was very special at the time. And it's interesting kind of Apple's relationship to DTP, because that was where I first encountered a Mac. My auntie ran a print shop. I remember her using a Quark Express, and that was the first time I ever got my hands on a Macintosh. But obviously in that era, like the late 80s to the mid 90s, so many different systems. You know, you generally use a different machine at home to what you'd use at school or at work, you know, because there's a lot of platforms around then. And I'm quite interested in what you said then about, you know, obviously that kind of post-Jobs era before he came back. Because I know Apple had quite a troubled time, like a lot of companies did in the mid-90s. Is kind of the Mac something that stayed in the American education system, or when Apple, because I mean, Apple were pretty close to bankruptcy at one point. Did it kind of go the way of the PC? What kind of happened there from your memory?
Yeah, so it was a little, definitely a hard time for Apple, especially in the late 90s. From the schools that I went to, primarily, even towards the iMac, they stayed with Apple. I think, you know, you have the infrastructure for Apple Talk. You had the legacy software with, even from the Apple IIgs, you know, that was something that kind of kept schools grounded into the Apple ecosystem. This 2GS was a kind of a reimagining of the Apple IIe, but with a new color, just, you know, higher, faster graphics, faster processor, basically redone everything. And with that machine, it also had backwards compatibility, so you could still load your old floppy games. And actually, most of the software that we ran was just old Apple IIe games running on this now new computer that came out in, I believe, 91. So the Apple II line was still being pulled into the 90s. Eventually, around like 94, 95, that's when we start seeing the low-cost Macs start to get introduced. And those are typically the Macintosh. Well, you usually see them as LC, like the LC575, the LC3. Those computers were all over schools and at home. I had one at home myself. They were low cost. They were easy to get. They were an all-in-one little package that you could easily, you know, put your floppy disk in, get AOL Instant Messenger running on it if you wanted to, and chat with your friends. You know, it was kind of like the iMac before the iMac, just beige and not as glamorous. But eventually schools, unfortunately for Apple, and once the iMac came out and Apple kind of positioned themselves as more of a premium brand and more of a, you know, brand that's more for creatives, and they're marketing more towards the high end, you know, with the G3s, with the iMac. I noticed, and, you know, with my parents being teachers, I noticed that they were starting to swap out their legacy Apple machines for PCs. And a lot of that, unfortunately, was also led by just the business industry.
Yeah.
Right? When you go out into the workforce, most of the time here in the States, you're not given a Mac for your work PC. It's a PC. You're given a little ThinkPad or sometimes...
Unless you work in marketing or advertising or something, yeah.
Right. So in order to train the workforce, I think, you know, they were starting to get away from a lot of what I feel is like the more creative side, like Logo. They were getting away from that, getting away from the edutainment software like Oregon Trail, and moving more towards teaching kids how to use a computer for the sake of writing and
Microsoft Office and
the boring stuff, which is I think is more of, you know, personally speaking, if you want somebody to be interested and really big and excited about computers and you want somebody to understand how it works, that you should try to get them excited and, you know, like the Logo thing. Let's actually get a kid excited and actually can manipulate stuff on screen, not just write a one-page story on Microsoft Word or make a chart with Excel.
I was wondering how you got your kind of knowledge about the Macs. Did you read any magazines, and were you ripping them apart as well? Because looking at Macs, you know, they're kind of, out of all the computers, they look like ones which are like, don't touch my insides. You know, of ones you kind of take them apart quite easily.
Yeah. When I was younger, I would always flip through my friends at elementary school, Macworld magazine. Magazines were a little bit harder to come by, I guess. Or I grew up in a smaller town, so we didn't have like a big bookstore or anything. What I did was get, is the sneaker net, right? Get floppy disks with like demos and stuff from my friend Kyle from down the street, or some of my elementary school friends. At school, they would bring some shareware games and we would play them during recess. And that would be how I learned about the new software. Or, you know, my friend, his dad was an attorney, and he had like, he would always be getting the latest and greatest Mac. So I would go to his house and there would be a Power Mac Tower. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know they came in that shape. And I just had my LC575 and I was trying to, you know, expand my knowledge. So then that started the whole like, okay, how do I upgrade my Mac? How do you upgrade the memory and stuff?
Those towers were easier to take apart, weren't they? Because yes, they were just a latch that you'd pull and
yeah,
it would all open up.
But I also, you know, I hate to admit, but I did go, my parents eventually did move to the PC route because that's what they ended up moving to in school. So I think by the time I was in 14 or so, that's when we got a PC at home. And that's when I started learning, okay, how do you open a PC, an IBM Aptiva? And so I learned, you know, I'm not just all Apple. I actually did have an Amiga too when I was younger.
Nice.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
I think in that regard, the Amiga and the Mac have kind of got, you know, a lot in common in, you know, in terms of the fan base have both got, you know, obviously a very loyal community around them. Obviously, the Mac was much more successful and continues to this day. And it's great to hear that, you know, you've kind of been a lifelong Apple fan as well. And tell us about kind of the process of deciding to document this stuff then. So how did Macintosh Librarian become a thing? And why did you decide to start a YouTube channel and show off some of this classic Apple hardware and software?
Yeah, so I think like a lot of nerds, we want to relive our retro past. Right now we're adults, we want to start collecting, we want to get stuff that we couldn't afford back then when we were younger. Like I said, my friend was his dad was an attorney, and so he was able to get these nice Macs. And now when I was older, I was like, okay, well, I want to get back into it. You know, I was into PCs. I had Macs as like my normal everyday machine. But then I want to say this was about 6 years ago or so, I started looking into classic Macintoshes again, you know, trying to find my old machines that I had when I was younger. I bought a Macintosh Classic and I wanted to learn how to resolder it. So I did that and I was, you know, felt pretty proud of myself. It wasn't the best soldering job, but, and then I kind of went from there of like, okay, what else is out there? And I realized that there was a great community of folks out there, like you mentioned. I had been listening to the, to y'all's podcast and to the Amigos retro gaming podcast as well. So I was into the Amiga stuff and that was kind of some of my nostalgia. There wasn't actually too much nostalgic Mac stuff, I guess, like back 6 years ago. And it wasn't until I saw Mac 84, Steve's stream, or he would stream and he would have videos. And I was using him in the past tense, but he still does now. And I realized that, oh, there's an awesome community out there, YouTube and in forums like 68K MLA forums. And I started asking people questions. Then I wanted to kind of, you know, throw my hat in the ring on YouTube. I used to fly drones, and I loved editing videos and I loved kind of putting a story together. And I wanted to kind of merge my kind of photography hobby, my computer hobby, and my video editing hobby all together into Macintosh library and YouTube channel.
I mean, for me, it's fascinating to watch your videos because I'm someone who kind of came really into the Apple world in the early 2000s. I mean, I was kind of aware of, you know, kind of what was going on in the 90s, but I didn't really, you know, get my first Mac until 2001. So kind of looking back at kind of the earlier machines, because there was quite a lot of different models and, yeah, you know, it was quite complex for someone. Yeah, a lot of them, yeah. And you make your channel really accessible as well. I mean, for people who haven't checked out your channel yet, obviously we'll link it up in the show notes. I think one thing that most people are drawn to initially is your AI assistant. You actually have a little helper on the channel called Mackie. So
yes.
Tell us about Mackie and kind of why you decided to have Mackie on the channel.
Yeah, so yes, Mackie is very popular. I don't want him to upstage me, but no, I have a little AI sidekick named Mackie, and he's not really AI. He's a sentient Macintosh. So
he's real.
But when I wanted to make a YouTube channel, so for anyone that hasn't seen my channel, I do go over kind of the history of different aspects of Apple, go into some of the Macintosh hardware, but I also wanted to make it a little bit more me, I guess. I wanted to have something that was a little whimsical, something that was cute, something that was fun, and something that would make people smile. And I originally thought of having like a puppet sidekick, like an actual, like a Muppet that I would make out of felt and have a talking computer. And then I realized that I could, you know, actually program one using HyperCard and some, you know, video editing tricks as well, to actually get a computer to talk and be my sidekick. So Mackie is, he's kind of a personification of a young kid that's really interested in things. He's always asking questions. He's always wanting to play computer games. In a way, he's kind of like all of us were when we were younger and in the 90s and 80s, just, you know, wanting to play games, just wanting to learn about everything. So He makes the channel, from what I hear from a lot of fans, that, you know, it's something that they can, it's a retro channel that they can watch with their kids, and even their kids are interested in it. So
I prefer him than Siri and Cortana, definitely.
I would love to get, and it's something that we're working on internally, is a Mackie that can actually respond to you talking to him live, you know, at a con and stuff. So that's something in the works.
Step aside, ChatGPT. Mackie's coming for you. Well, you also cover the next systems on your channel as well. Obviously, Steve Jobs' company after he left Apple in the 80s. And obviously, there's a big kind of crossover with the Mac world there when Jobs came back to Apple in the late 90s. And obviously, Next Step went on to form what is now the current Mac operating system for the last 20-odd years. So, I mean, where did your interest in Next come from then? And tell us kind of how that relates to your interest then, and is getting hold of that hardware a little bit more difficult than the Apple machines? Because I know they were very expensive when they were on sale.
Yeah, they were very expensive machines. But yeah, I think I wanted to, you know, there's a whole, while I am interested a lot in the non-Steve Jobs Macs, but I do like the Apple IIs and everything. But when I grew up, it was the 90s. Steve Jobs was kind of a little bit of an enigma. He wasn't at Apple, but, you know, there were still rumblings of this man, Steve Jobs, and he was off to this other company called Next. He was investing in Pixar. He was doing other stuff. And when he came back, it was a really big deal, and some of my nerd friends were talking about it, and I was like, who is this guy? And then that's when kind of sparked my curiosity of like, okay, he's, you know, he helped found the company and everything. But while he was gone, you know, he was creating these mysterious computers that were used for college and research and, you know, really marketed at the higher end technological user. And for Next machines are 68K based machines. Just, you know, they have a lot of custom chips on them. They have a lot of RAM. They're kitted out to where you can have a lot of extra slots for extra cards, you know, even though they didn't really make that many extra cards for them. But I was lucky enough to have a friend that lives nearby, and she, for a very generous price, donated a next cube and two next slabs and two giant monitors to the channel. And I kind of have a separate room. It's kind of a built-in office that I called the Jennifer Library Annex, which is all my next machines. And, you know, it's great seeing essentially what is kind of like an early revision of what we use now in our modern Macs.
That's an interesting thing to look back at as well, isn't it? That kind of next step Mac OS X kind of transition. I mean, I've done a video myself on my channel about the Mac OS X Cheetah, like the initial version of it, and the server, you know, and Rhapsody as well. It's all interesting to look at, isn't it? That intersection of how next step became Mac OS.
Right. And there was a little bit of time where that may not have happened. I think there is, while I haven't used too much BOS, but you know, that was an alternative. Jean-Louis Gasset, who was working at Apple, made his own company B, and that was being, you know, touted as possibly the next Mac OS, you know, after OS 9, and they wanted to revamp it. You know, what was next? What was going to be the next revamp operating system, OS 10? And next ended up winning out, which we're still using. There's code base of Next Step still being used today in Mac OS and on iPhones and all the iOS systems. So I think they made the right choice.
I think Dan actually dreams about the B-Box still.
I like Haiku, which is kind of a spiritual successor to BOS. You know, I use that in a couple of my machines, but yeah, that original B-Box, the hardware with those blinking lights on, you know, if people haven't seen that, they're, check it out on YouTube. It's like a beautiful machine. So that was an exciting time in computing, all these different platforms and just kind of, you know, not knowing kind of what would make it and what wouldn't.
Right. Yeah. I think I was a kid during all this time. So these were computers that you would, you know, read about in Macworld, or you would hear glimmers of when you're at the computer store, or you might see a poster for it. But even at like your normal, you know, Best Buy computer store, you're not going to see a Next machine. That was mail order. You had to be in California to get that fancy stuff. So it's nice being able to actually have it now, even though it's obsolete. It's still nice to have.
And there was also those clones as well, which are really interesting because everybody, you know, looks at a Mac and thinks it's a Mac, but then suddenly there's a power computing machine or something coming out. Did you have any clones back in the days, and were you aware of them?
I actually did not know when I was younger that clones were a thing. I know that, you know, I would go to CompUSA with my dad and we would look at the computers, and I don't think I put two and two together that some of these computers that we're looking at were Mac clones. It wasn't until I was older doing research on, you know, the history of Apple, especially during the 90s, that I realized that, oh yeah, during OS 8, there was a lot of clones. The Apple kind of opened up their platform to be accessible to clone manufacturers. So Motorola, Power Computing out of Austin, UMAX, and probably some others I'm forgetting, all had, you know, they could develop their own PowerPC based Macintosh. And I think while that was really good for consumers and it made for very accessible and low cost Macs, I think Apple ended up kind of cannibalizing their own sales because these clone manufacturers, and I have a video on the Power Computing clone machine, you know, it was easy to upgrade. It was cheaper, probably by like $1,000 or so, and this is back in the 90s. These are Clinton dollars, so that's a lot of money. And you know, they were outperforming and outclassing the regular Macs that were for sale. And I think that was, while it was great that there were more Mac OS users, I think in the end, Apple was mostly a hardware company, not a software company. So they were definitely shooting themselves in the foot there.
Yeah, they had some really fast, crazy upgrades. And I actually heard of them from the Amiga scene, because Amiga had gone a PowerPC at that point. And companies like Power Computing kind of moved on to doing accelerators for the Amiga as well.
Yeah, there was definitely a parallel path almost for the Apple architecture and some of the Amiga architecture, you know, both 68K based. And then there was no, you know, what's after the 68060? 040, sure. But, you know, 060 was rare and wasn't really utilized. And then it was PowerPC. And the accelerators and, you know, upgrade cards for, I have a couple upgrade cards, and Apple developed some themselves that helped upgrade some 040 machines.
There were those Sonnet cards as well that came out.
Yes, Sonnet also made some. Yes, Sonnet.
I've seen people with those in their Amiga 4000s and hacked drivers, and they're running PowerPC stuff on there. It's pretty amazing.
It's pretty crazy what you were able to do back then, because you, for example, the Power Computing computer, it's a tongue twister, but that machine originally shipped with, I believe, a 100 megahertz PowerPC, but it had a processor card that's essentially kind of like a PCI card that you can just pull the processor out. And then it could accept all the way up to a G4 processor or a higher end G3. And I was able to upgrade my PowerPC machine up to 400 megahertz.
That's crazy.
So that's actually 500 megahertz. So Yeah, we're talking about a 5X upgrade, right? If you had the right card. And sure, those cards, you look at the old magazines and you realize that card itself would have cost more than the computer that you're putting it in. But now, you know, you can find a great deal on eBay or make a trade and get some of this power that we could have had.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite, you know, Amiga in quotes is actually a Mac Mini G4 running an operating system called MorphOS, which is kind of a descendant of the Amiga OS. So there's definitely that big crossover there, you know, the PowerPC hardware. And I know you cover, one thing I love in your channel as well is all the modifications that you do as well. I mean, one video that I love that you did a few months ago is when you converted a beige Macintosh SE30 into a red Mac case, like a candy apple red case from MacFX.com as well. So these kind of modifications and stuff that you did. Tell us about some of your favorite mods that you've done and any that you've got your eye on at the moment that you'd like to do in the future.
Yeah, no, that was an awesome mod. The MacFX team, they're a store online. They develop clear injection molded cases that are really good reproductions of old compact Mac cases. And so I was lucky enough to get my hands on all the colors. They have a clear, red, green, and blue. And I built out the red one. You know, you swap out the old yellow case, still keep the case for a different project for later. But maybe retro-bright it or something. But then you get to replace it with this transparent red case that's very reminiscent of like toys and, you know, the transparent Game Boys and even like the iMac. So all those clear plastics were really big in the 90s. So it's really awesome to see folks make some of this new hardware for these old machines. And you know, there's been a lot of other stuff too, like, you know, the Blue SCSI, SCSI to SD, all these drive emulators that I'm sure you guys are familiar with also that, you know, help extend the life of our old machines and get rid of those spinning platter drives and replace it with, you know, SD cards and solid state memory, and, you know, adds Wi-Fi to it and adds virtual SCSI devices to where you can hot swap CDs from an ISO and all these neat things that are adding a lot of creature comforts. And a lot of this wasn't even there just, five years ago. We're starting to see a lot more folks, with this technical knowledge come into the field.
Yeah, I saw your Blue SCSI video as well, and I've got a 512K, and I'm kind of thinking about hooking that up with some kind of hard drive solution. But also, there was another SCSI device, RAS SCSI, and you had like an online connectivity with that, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, the RAS SCSI project is now called PySCSI. But essentially, it lets you use a Raspberry Pi, even a Raspberry Pi 4, maybe even 5. I haven't tested it yet, but to act as a SCSI emulator. And it acts as you can have a web daemon running on the Raspberry Pi. You can connect to it with your PC or your Mac and modify, which image you want loaded, download files from the web, and even act as a virtual Ethernet card so that it can essentially trick your Mac to think that it has a SCSI Ethernet card connected to it, but it's all virtual. So that project and the Blue SCSI project, which also now has integrated a lot of that Ethernet emulation features into it, which is really awesome because the Pi Zero W. That allows people to use Wi-Fi easily connected to the Blue SCSI and allows people to send files. And it's can really, adding Wi-Fi to a computer from the 80s or 90s is pretty amazing to see.
And I thought it was great that you had the file sharing in there because that's something really powerful, yes. That other systems don't really have. And it really took advantage of that. And you did that in the Basilisk emulator video as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of, Apple had thankfully a lot of, they wanted their computers to be used in offices and schools. So they had this Apple Talk network protocol that allowed, essentially it was a token ring network. So it was slow, but it allowed the computers to talk to each other, send files one to another, allow users to print to one shared printer. And there's actually a group of folks now that are starting a project that they call, I believe it's called GlobalNet or GlobalTalk. And it's a Apple Share that's on the internet. And so a bunch of folks are getting their Macs connected like it's, like a LAN party, but it's online. So that's something I need to hop into now. Haven't done it yet, but I think when y'all are listening to this, try to check out Global Talk.
It's interesting that in the last few years, obviously it's been almost 20 years, amazingly, since Apple started to hop off the PowerPC platform and transition to Intel in 2005, 2006. Does it kind of feel like to you that there's been a resurgence of maybe nostalgia for the PowerPC era? Because, you go on websites like Macintosh Garden, for example, which is a great archive of Mac software, and you can see there are modern web browsers for PowerPC Macs. Like, there's one called Interweb PPC, which lets you surf the web on classic PowerPC Macs. There's also projects like the Sorbet Leopard operating system, which is basically a bit of an update for the Leopard OS for the PPC. Does it kind of feel like that the PowerPC scene is becoming more active again recently, and people are more nostalgic for it?
Definitely. I think it's actually the M1 and the Apple Silicon processors. It kind of maybe reminded some folks that, at one point Apple was using these kind of bespoke processors. Mm. And, they were running, especially the early macOS 10 days, macOS 9, macOS 8 with PowerPC. That's kind of the sweet spot for a lot of nostalgia. You're hitting that early internet time period where the technology was still nascent and people were still using AOL chat rooms and stuff. And I think there's a lot of, especially for us millennials, a lot of nostalgia tied around that. Mm. And with, there's the PowerPC challenge that the Mac Yak folks put on every January, and You know, there's a lot of folks like Dostune that are still doing a lot of great upgrades for PowerPC software machines to try to keep those machines alive. And I have a few PowerPC. I have a G5 tower, G4 tower, G3 tower, and, you know, the bubble IMAX, the colored ones. And they are, you know, they're really great machines. And it's nice to, it's a time when it was kind of Apple's renaissance in a way. And I think a lot of people like that about Apple. And I think they're kind of going through a little bit of a renaissance now, or they at least were with, you know, the M1s. People started, when they dropped Intel, a lot of people started seeing that kind of revitalization of kind of how it felt like in the PowerPC era.
Yeah, because it felt then that, obviously, like you said, Apple had the custom hardware, and even, you know, the tagline then was, you know, think different. Which, you know, it felt like you're using something different to the mainstream, which, like you said, with the M1, M2, M3 processors, it kind of feels a bit like that's returned again. I mean, I guess it's more of an attitude thing, isn't it, with Apple users in that regard, just kind of having their own hardware, their own ecosystem, and something to be proud of that's different to the mainstream.
It definitely differentiates the user, or at least the product, whenever you can. It's hard to put like an apples to apples comparison against like a M3. Mac versus a, you know, whatever Intel i9. They're just two separate animals, right? One's very low power, one's very high power, blah, blah, blah. And I think it helps, you know, there's always a little bit of a smugness with a lot of Apple users, but it definitely helps differentiate, you know, the crowd.
Will you ever like do some real gaming content, because you know, there's the Apple Pippin, and I'd love to actually see Mackie appear on the front of a Pippin and be controlled with a wireless controller. That would be really cool.
That would be awesome. I've been eyeing some Japanese auctions to get my hands on a Pippin. I've spoken to a few Pippin fans at VCF West, and I have some software hookups. But yes, we have plans to do some Mackie plays videos and some get into some more games, whether it's Mac related. I also, when I was younger, was into Sega stuff.
Yeah.
And so I kind of want to start incorporating some of that, you know, Sega Genesis, maybe even throw in some of my old Amiga games in there as well.
Well, you have actually done some gaming on there, kind of joking aside. You've done like, well, Oregon Trail, but also the edutainment kind of software there as well, which is really important. And I think that stuff really stands out when you're learning on a computer. And, you know, people have huge nostalgia for kind of like edutainment and those kind of titles as well.
Yeah, I think Apple and gaming, especially in the 90s, didn't really go together, right? Most people were gaming on their consoles or something. But when Apple, since they were in schools, you know, a lot of companies were trying to find something that can not only be entertaining for a kid, but also help them learn. So whether that's learning the history of the American trail towards the West, the Oregon Trail, or learning how to type through like Mavis Beacon, or you know, learning math through like Math Blasters or Number Munchers or Word Munchers, learning English. There's definitely a lot more edutainment titles for the Mac, which I find to be, you know, those are a lot of my nostalgia. Growing up in classroom settings, those are the games that I played a lot.
And of course, the cooler shareware scene that they had as well.
Yes, yes. That was, you know, games like Glypha, Glider, Power Pete. It was like a top-down shooter game. Those are some of my favorite games that were shareware, if not pirated, back in the day. There was a lot of great games. It's nice to see that there's, you know, when I was a kid, I thought like, oh, I'm the only one that knows about Glypha, for instance, which is a Joust clone for the Mac. And, you know, start doing the YouTube channel, I have a video that's all about Glypha, which was one of my favorite games. And the creator of Glypha ends up reaching out to me. He was an ex-Apple employee, and he was saying he's retired. and he's remaking Glyphah for Steam. And you know, he gave me a bunch of Steam keys and got an early preview. And it was really awesome to actually, you know, kind of meet your childhood hero in a way.
Well, that's one great thing about today. I mean, the Mac community, I mentioned Macintosh Garden before. You've also got MacintoshRepository.org, which is a great website. You know, all that software you may have missed back in the day before we were all connected is readily available now to download. But if people are maybe listening to our chat, Kate, and they're thinking, you know, I'd like to get into this kind of the retro Mac scene. I do find that, you know, over here in the UK in particular, the PowerPC Macs are still quite affordable. I mean, you can pick up like a G4 or a G5 generally for less than £100. What would kind of be your advice for people that want to explore this scene, maybe in terms of what's the best machine to pick up and any things to look for, like, you know, maybe leaking caps or batteries, any that are more reliable than others, and maybe operating systems as well. I know that, like, for example, OS X Tiger is generally regarded as maybe the sweet spot because you can run the classic stuff as well. Is there any kind of sweet configuration or machine that you'd say people should jump into if they want to explore it?
Yeah, it really depends on what era of nostalgia you want to jump into, right? Like, I think for some people, that would be like the System 7, 755 era. And like that would be like a 68040 Macintosh, like an LC575. I think if you can get your hands on a SE30, or even a Macintosh SE, those typically are easier to repair. The boards are bigger. The components are mass produced. They're a little bit easier to repair, find the parts for. That's kind of the black and white compact area. So that would kind of be like if you want to go really old school. And then if you want to get something that's a little bit more advanced, like you're talking about G3, I think getting a G3 blue and white tower, you see those a lot in recycling centers. Those are fairly easy to come by. And
save them if you see them in recycling centers. Grab them.
Yes, for sure. I think those are great machines because those are not only powerful enough to run, you know, early versions of OS X, but they can run the classic Mac OS 9 and Mac OS 8.6. So you can live kind of that border of, you know, the late 90s Mac. You can play some of those more, you know, towards the end of the 90s, you're getting games like Tomb Raider and, you know, the original Halo was supposed to be a Mac game, but, you know, Bungie made Marathon for the Mac. And so you get starting to get some 3D accelerated games in there too as well.
I went to VCF East and I was amazed at the amount of Mac that was there. Action Retro was there, but also there was a lot of, Mac users coming up and people intrigued and that whole American Mac culture. I wasn't really aware that it was that big. What's it going to like going to VCF and, you know, seeing everyone and taking Mackie out there to the public?
Everyone loves Mackie because I have him, you know, for the radio listeners out there, he's a SE30 with a little face on it, and he talks and his eyes move around, and you know, his face is on the screen, and everyone thinks he's really cute. Kids want to come over and pet him and talk to him, and it's really nice to see the positive reactions for everybody. Some people have maybe never even heard of the channel before, but you know, they recognize, you know, the Mac as being a friendly computer and a personable computer. And I think, you know, all the folks, in the United States, of course, there's a lot of Apple fans, and it's nice to see that kind of connection that they have. So not only to Mackie, but just to Macs and Apple in general.
I saw a photo of Bill Hurd hugging Mackie as well, which I thought was really cool.
Yes. I met him at VCF West, or actually invited me out to VCF West to be on a YouTube panel. And he held Mackie and he said, "This is actually the first time I've held one of these," meaning an Apple Macintosh. And I was like, oh, wow.
Because Bill was a Commodore engineer. Bill's a Commodore engineer for people that don't know. Yeah. So getting him to hug a Mac was a big step, I think, Mark.
Yes. Yes. And it was a big step for him. He was I was proud of him.
Well, your channel, I mean, it just goes from strength to strength. I mean, you cover some incredible subjects on there as well. I'm looking through some of your recent videos, you know, running macOS on an Apple Vision Pro is your latest one. You do great community videos as well, where, you know, you unbox things from your audience. And, you know, obviously we mentioned about those upgrades that you do as well. So a great selection of all things kind of classic Mac and Next as well, like we said too. What's kind of your future plans for the channel, and anything coming up over the next like couple of months that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, so actually this month is Marchintosh, so the retro community comes together. We celebrate everything Macintosh and retro Macintosh related. And you know, my channel is always about the Macintosh, but I wanted to participate too and have a video that was kind of taking us back to our roots. And let's talk about the original Macintosh, the original 128K 1984 Macintosh, and, you know, what it was like running System 1 on it. How do you get that set up? You know, what does it look like inside? How do you revamp it? And, you know, the history of what led up to the original Macintosh. So that's one video that I'm currently working on now. I also have a couple hardware videos where I'm planning on, it's been in the works for a while now, but I'm developing a way to connect an LCD panel to a SE or SE30 with some parts from one of my friends, Ron of Ron's Computer Videos. We're able to get VGA out of a SE board, and, you know, with some 3D printed parts that I designed, we can mount an LCD screen in there. So I'm working on an LCD Mac.
Fantastic. Well, obviously, I'll link up your channel in the show notes as well. Particularly, you know, we have maybe a lot of European listeners, because the Mac wasn't all that big over here, you know, in the 80s and 90s. I think for us, it's kind of getting our eyes on maybe a platform that we didn't know all that much about. And I find that aspect of it really interesting as well. So I'd encourage everyone to go along and check out your channel, because you present it in such an accessible way and a really fun way as well, and your knowledge is, you know, second to none. So keep up the good work on the channel, Kate, and it's been an absolute pleasure reminiscing about all things Apple with you on the podcast this week.
Thank you, it's been fun.